This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, welcome to the show. Now, beginning with Vanessa, let's first talk about what the motive could be behind this operation. The majority of the experts and analysts that we've spoken to, speaking of provoking Iran, Israel trying to provoke Iran into engaging in war so that Israel could spread further instability and insecurity across the region. Your thought on this?
Well, I think just before Christmas last year, Yoav Gallant made it quite clear that they needed a victory in this war in order to survive. So in the Middle East, so this is an existential war for Israel. It's been evident since October the 7th that they are desperately losing the war in Gaza against a relatively ill-equipped Palestinian resistance. They have had to evacuate from the northern occupied territories more than 100,000 settlers, as far as we know, in the contained war against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And so now they deem it necessary to expand the war, particularly into Syria, because we have to remember that this is the fourth in a series of attacks in the last 7 days. And all of these attacks have been carried out in conjunction with an upsurge in attacks by the terrorist groups across all the axes, particularly in the northwest and in central Syria. So, you know, the masks have fallen. People can now see exactly who is the real axis of evil in the region, the real axis of terrorism. Those that are silent about this appalling attack, people in Damascus, are still in shock that this has actually happened. I mean, this is an escalation beyond expectations. So Israel wants to expand the war. The resistance axis has been trying to restrict that expansion, but it remains to be seen if that remains the status quo.
All right. Now, let me turn to Vienna. Richard, the UK just a couple of hours ago summoned the Israeli ambassador, and that because three British aid workers got killed in Gaza. Now, when it comes to proportionality, you tell me, what is then Iran entitled to do now that it's lost several of its senior nuclear scientists and also military commanders at the hands of the Israeli regime?
Well, the Israelis want the Iranians to turn this into a full-blown war because it would suit them. But I think, you know, the axis of resistance, not just Iran, but all of the resistance have proven over time that they are not ones to be tricked or to fall into traps. Although it's understandable that Iran's response should be just disproportionate. I think that, as Iran have said, and they always respond and they will do it at the right time. Regarding the British summoning over the killing of three aid workers, what's interesting is that we have a chorus. We have all of these Western officials talking about the world central kitchen issue in Gaza, which is important. But they're doing that to avoid talking about this unprecedented attack on the embassy. I mean, speaking of proportionality, we have to talk about this more because, you know, we've never seen a so-called state attacking the embassy of another state in a third state. I mean, this is a violation of the UN Charter. It's a violation of the Vienna Convention, the Geneva Convention. It's so egregious. It's unprecedented. And the fact that the British government don't even care enough to summon the Israelis over that alone, or any other ambassadors that are in Europe or the West to be summoned over this issue is scandalous, and it really shows you where their priorities lie.
Right. Now, Vanessa, some observers citing the reason for Israel to do this as an act of desperation, and that's mostly thanks to the failures it's facing in Gaza. It's not been able to defeat one single resistance group in Palestinian occupied territories, you know, and also maybe these anti-Netanyahu protests on the home turf, you know, a host of, you know, issues, the Israeli economy and all that. Do you share the same view?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned, you know, Israel is not only losing the strategic and military war, it's losing desperately the propaganda war, its entire edifice of propaganda that has propped it up for since its creation as a illegal settler colonialist state by the British, and then of course it was adopted by the States. The entire anti-Semitism trope has been destroyed, particularly of course by the case of Professor David Miller, that has now stated very clearly that being anti-Zionism is acceptable. And you know, their entire defense for this genocide that they're committing, not only in Gaza but in the West Bank, which is based upon an entire series of lies that they produced from October the 7th onwards that have now gradually been completely debunked. The world is seeing them as they are, and their economy has taken a massive hit. Military morale is at its lowest. Settlers are leaving the Zionist entity itself. And the Zionist entity can only survive with settler support. So if settlers are starting to decide that it's no longer offering them security, they will leave. And then what is left? And also, you know, which country in its right mind now is going to be looking at investment in the future in a country that is clearly responsible for genocide of Palestinians across the territories?
Now, Richard, why shouldn't they learn a lesson from their past mistakes? Like when they assassinated Iran General Soleimani, what did they gain? The resistance front even got stronger and got, you know, a boost up in the arm. Now they are again killing Iranian commanders at a lower level compared to General Soleimani, the icon of the anti-terror and anti-Daesh, actually. In this part of the world?
I mean, without question, they gained nothing. The resistance got stronger. We can see the same pattern with Hamas, for example, when the Israelis thought, okay, if they assassinate Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, that this will destroy Hamas. Look at Hamas today. I mean, they've launched a full-blown war, and they can't even defeat them. So imagine with Iran how much stronger that is. It's, you know, the axis of resistance has shown over time that no matter what actions the Israelis and Americans take, they are losing on the chessboard. They simply cannot get around the failures that they are, you know, experiencing at home, so to speak, and on the battlefield. And this is actually why they assassinate. They lash out like a cat, you know, clawing someone, because they are terrorists deep down. This is who they really are. And it's not just the assassination of the high-ranking officials here. It's really, we have to understand this as an attack on Iran itself, because that's really what it is. You know, the Israelis have done this these attacks on Iran and its sovereignty before, and the same thing with Syria, but this is on an unprecedented level. And, you look at the terror at Al-Shifa Hospital. This is something, in my opinion, that they were trying to hide and distract from. But again, it's on a deeper level here. The Israelis are trying to find some kind of victory. They think that they can overcome their failures by assassinating people, and it's not going to happen. And I should point something out, that they are doing this on multiple levels. We had a terrorist attack in January in Iran, which ISIS supposedly claimed responsibility for it. Mm-hmm. We had another ISIS attack in Russia. We had a recent terrorist attack in China. Do we really think this is a coincidence that there are all these assassinations? General Mousavi is another one, Saleh Haruri, and all these terrorist attacks by ISIS and Al-Qaeda who are known to have links to America and Israel. It's not a coincidence.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Vanessa, Richard mentioned something, and what the Israeli regime did is actually a violation of Iran. It means an attack on Iran because a sovereign country's diplomatic premises was targeted and hit. It was also the host country's. So it's a violation of international law and conventions because it was diplomatic premises. Both, you know, the host country was violated and also Iran. So who should hold this regime accountable for such an action?
Well, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, the Iranian foreign minister was quite clear that he holds Washington responsible. Washington, the UK, and the EU, and the allies of Israel have continued supplying weapons to Israel to conduct and carry out the genocidal campaign in Palestine, right. But they're also supplying the weapons to carry out these kind of assassinations. And it, as you've mentioned, it's not the first, particularly on Syrian territory. And this was what made it even more heinous for me and why everybody here is still in shock. This was around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, so 2 hours before Iftar, the breaking of fast during Ramadan. Right. It was packed full of people, the equivalent to Oxford Circus, in London, and as you said, it targets what is effectively a diplomatic zone. It was the consular section, which is actually the residence, if I understand it, of the ambassador. Mm-hmm. General Zahedi was there under diplomatic immunity. So this is actually a terrorist act. I mean, I consider Israel to be a terrorist state anyway for all of its other actions, but this was a clear, under international law, a terrorist act. And yet there has been the only country calling for an emergency session at the UN Security Council is Russia. The West is saying absolutely nothing. In response, for example, the US State Department spokesperson mumbled his way through his usual excuses for Israel. And this is appalling because this is plunging us into an abyss of global insecurity. The last time that this kind of act took place was a bombing by the U.S. of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, which killed three Chinese diplomats, for which the U.S. apologized and said it was a mistake. Whether we believe that or not is by the by. Mm-hmm. But this is unbelievable. Israel is pushing the boundaries of all conventions, human rights conventions, Geneva conventions, Vienna conventions, and yet the response, imagine if, for example, Russia had bombed a U.S. embassy on another country's territory, what would the response be? We would be at war now.
Exactly. Now, Richard, Vanessa mentioned the role of the U.S., so to what extent could Washington be blamed for such acts that would further actually embolden the Tel Aviv regime to perpetrate more such crimes? Also, let's bear in mind that it was U.S.-made fighter jets, it was F-35 jets performing the strikes against the Iranian embassy.
The U.S. are absolutely responsible. It's as if an American pilot dropped it himself. The U.S. Air Force dropped it themselves. There is absolutely no distinction here. And we really need to be clear on this. The United States and Israel are one, and they attacked Iran together. The munitions, the payloads, the ordnances, every nut and bolt in that fighter jet and the six missiles that were fired were manufactured by American companies. The U.S. government manufactured this and then gave an export license and permission to give this to the Zionists. And then said nothing and continues to say nothing after, you know, we have diplomats killed. I mean, even if nobody was killed, the symbolic act of attacking an embassy is outrageous. It is beyond. It is unconscionable. It is truly beyond words. I still can't digest it. You know, even after 24 hours, it is so outrageous. And as Vanessa pointed out, the Israelis. I mean, is there a law that they haven't broken in any jurisdiction under any convention? I don't know at this point. But the Americans have to be held responsible. And you know, a proper government, a real government, one that cares about international law, a civilized government, would have immediately, cut ties with the Israelis a long time ago, by the way. But after this act, let's say, cut ties and cut exports and, held an emergency session, called for an emergency session at the UN Security Council and apologized for providing these weapons.
Right. Now, Vanessa, there were multiple countries and international bodies, including the United Nations, for instance, they've all condemned this Israeli act of terrorism, except the West. So what is this indicative of?
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, the masks are off. The fact that these U.S.-backed Zionist attacks on Syrian territory against Iranian military, against Hezbollah, against the Islamic resistance, against Syrian Arab army forces and national defense forces, because as I said, we shouldn't forget Israel carried out the attack in the northeast. Israel violated Syrian airspace and targeted east and west of Aleppo, enabling a terrorist attack on the western Aleppo axis. It carried out an attack on the Research and Development Center in Jamraya on the morning of this assassination. There, the fires were burning for more than 6 hours. And then finally, this assassination. So in 1 week, Israel has violated, it's effectively declared war multiple times, and it's only because of the restraint of the resistance axis that we are not right now in a full-blown global war. And the thing is that Israel keeps pushing, it keeps provoking, and even though the response from the resistance has been very much a deterrent response, which is understandable, where do we go next? Are they going to bomb the presidential palace? Are they going to bomb central Tehran? I mean, this is the thing. To what extent are Israel going to push this? To what extent do they want to expand this war?
Yeah, I don't think they dare to do that in a way. Now, Richard, Tel Aviv, what is it doing exactly? Is it playing global bully, an outlaw or rogue regime? What is it that Israel is exactly doing, given all the crimes it's been committing in Gaza, this recent terrorist attack at Iran embassy? Is there anything on the planet that is not viable for this regime? And then they depict Iran as a menace to regional security.
No, there is nothing that the Zionists will not do. What's funny to me is that today you can be arrested on the streets of London for saying you support Hamas or you support the Palestinian resistance. And the police who arrest you for this would have been killed by the Israelis a few decades ago because this is the nature of the Israelis, and they have done this. So, whether we look at the attacks on Iran, the attacks on Britain, there's a history since the very beginning, going back a century, of the Israelis behaving in this. They have effectively invented modern terrorism, and I really mean that in the literal full sense of the term. The Israelis invented modern terrorism. They started mailing parcel bombs, letter bombs, planting bombs around London. Why wouldn't they bomb their neighbors? This is how they stole the land, is it not?
Right.
And so because Iran is the only one helping everyone to stand up for themselves and defend themselves, they try and go after Iran. It's that simple. There's no other explanation.
So, Richard, we have just 1 minute. So, Vanessa, what do you see on the horizon for the West Asia region, given all this warmongering by the U.S. and Israel?
I think escalation is almost unavoidable. I mean, as I said, inside Syria now we have an increase in the terrorist attack across all axes. Really, everybody is waiting to see what Iran's response will be, and then, of course, how the Zionists will respond to that. So I think we're in abeyance, but I think we're preparing for further escalation.
Okay. That's all the time we have for this episode. Thank you so much, Vanessa Billy, in Damascus, Richard Methurst in Vienna.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, we need to abstain from more than just food and water in the holy month of Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, it is an honor to be here at your service, the holy month of Ramadan. What a beautiful month indeed, a difficult month, trials, tribulations, hunger, thirst in the holy month of Ramadan. But it is difficult, you know, we don't eat, we don't drink, we kind of break ourselves from this materialistically imposed, you know, schedule and routine that we have. We break out of it and we're trying to go into a more, you know, spiritually oriented schedule and lifestyle. So, of course, it is going to be a little bit difficult, but, you know, we have to hang in there and be strong, and we'll be able to get through it, and we'll be a much better person, inshallah, by the end of the holy month of Ramadan. So we're talking about how we need to abstain from a little bit more than just food and water. Now, of course, the most basic elements and the basic necessities of a human being is food and water. I mean, can there be anything more basic than food and water in a human being's life? So, but despite it being basic, it is also very fundamental. I mean, if you don't eat or drink, you know, for a prolonged period of time, you most probably will die, right? I mean, I think that's the scientific consensus. So when we're talking about not eating and drinking, yes, this is a very big deal. You know, it is a basic thing. And when you realize that you are able to overcome such a basic and fundamental physical aspect of yourself, you know, then you realize that you can probably overcome a lot of other physical, you know, barriers or obstacles that are created because you have the power to be able to overcome such basic and fundamental aspects of your physical self that you will be able to, you know, overcome other ones as well.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان رمضان رمضان القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how we need to refrain and protect ourselves from things that are more than just food and water. So food and water, of course, being a basic necessity, is something that we need to refrain from in the holy month of Ramadan. And there's certain other jurisprudentially forbidden things, you know, that can break our fast that we also need to stay away from in the holy month of Ramadan. But it's not just limited to this, right? When we go towards the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, we find that they emphasize the fact that merely, you know, refraining from food and water is not going to cut it, especially when, you know, we indulge, unfortunately, or we commit sins. So, you know, for example, God forbid, we lie, we backbite, we cheat, we steal, we rob, you know, I don't know, we slander. For example, we look at things that are prohibited, or we listen to things that are prohibited, or we say things that are prohibited, right? These things, they might not jurisprudentially break our fast, but we need to stay away from them because, one, they defeat the purpose of fasting, which is self-purification, and these things, they, you know, they corrupt us, they taint us, they kind of stain us. You know, because they're sins, and that's what sins do. They taint and they corrupt, you know, and they are a blotch upon one's self. So, yes, not eating and drinking is a basic thing that we need to do, but we also need to refrain from committing many of these other sins that really, you know, don't help us to attain self-purification in the holy month of Ramadan.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
توفیق الهی امت اسلامی و ملت مسلمان فلسطین بر دشمنان خودشون قطعا پیروز خواهند شد و خواهند دید اون روزی را که ریشه رژیم جعلی صهیونیست از سرزمین فلسطین کنده خواهد شد.
With God's grace and divine providence, the Islamic Ummah and the Palestinian nation will emerge victorious, inflicting a decisive defeat on their enemies. And we shall see the day when the fake Zionist regime will be uprooted once and for all from the land of Palestine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Islamic resistance in Iraq has been standing in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza by carrying out retaliatory operations in the region. Resistance forces in Iraq have started their operations by striking a number of U.S. military bases in Iraq and Syria in response to Washington's support for Israel. The operations have now entered a new phase as Israeli positions have been directly targeted in various locations such as Haifa, Eilat, and elsewhere.
We have always been firm in our stance to support the people of Palestine. The Palestinian cause is central to the axis of resistance that has supported the people of Gaza by striking Israeli positions. The regime's positions, whether it's ports in the Mediterranean or elsewhere, are targeted using ballistic missiles, drones, and all other weapons by our brothers in Yemen, Lebanon, and here in Iraq. The operations are clear evidence that the axis of resistance works in harmony and has the strategic potential and the means to pressure Israel and those states that support the systematic killing of innocent civilians.
The intensification of the attacks on Israeli positions shows that the massacres being committed by the regime in Gaza will not remain unanswered. The second phase of the operations, which directly targeted Israeli positions, proves that regional resistance groups are able to inflict serious damage to Israel's maritime and airspace interests.
Resistance groups in Iraq and across the region have proved their ability to respond to the Israeli crimes against innocent civilians. They vow that their operations will intensify even more as long as the genocidal war on Gaza continues. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
under the title Flood of the Free and as part of the activities scheduled to commemorate Al-Quds International Day. The Permanent Committee of Al-Quds International Day organized a political forum this Tuesday at Al-Assad Library in Damascus. The Iranian ambassador said that defending Palestinians is the duty of the free world.
We will continue to defend Palestine because it is a fundamental principle, not a time-bound interest. All free people in the world must support the Palestinian people, as today we witnessed the Zionist entity committing various crimes, from killing innocent people to the recent attack on the embassy building. The response of Islamic Republic of Iran will be proportional to the Zionist assassination crime.
During the ceremony, Syrian and Palestinian researchers and specialists focused on the need to preserve the achievements made in Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. They condemned the Israeli criminal aggression against the Iranian embassy.
We offer our condolences to the Islamic Republic of Iran on the martyrdom of Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi and his comrades who were martyred in the Zionist attack on the Iranian embassy building in Damascus. We affirm Syria's solidarity with Iran, which is facing these attacks due to the hysteria of the defeated entity in its war against the Palestinian people in Gaza.
The researchers considered that Al-Quds International Day should be an opportunity to increase public pressure on the international community to force the Israeli regime to stop its war on Gaza.
The Zionist enemy is trying to send a message that resistance comes at a high cost through the destruction of Gaza, killing and genocide, unaware that our peoples cannot be intimidated. Al-Aqsa flood operation overthrew and buried all the sectarian projects sown by Western colonialism and the Zionist entity.
What makes Al-Quds International Day this year special is the steadfastness of the resistance and the people of Gaza, who thwarted the goals of the Israeli enemy. The symposium concluded that Al-Quds International Day has consolidated the concept of resistance, while Al-Aqsa Flood operation proved that with strong faith, the oppressed Palestinian people can achieve victory over the Zionist occupation. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has accepted his party's defeat in the local elections. From the headquarters of his Justice and Development Party, also known as the AK ruling party in Ankara, Erdogan appeared with his wife, thanking his supporters for participating in the elections and admitting his loss. Erdogan assured that the results were a turning point for his party and vowed to respect the nation's decision. For his turn, the AKP candidate Murat Kurum expressed his gratitude to his supporters and a promise to continue working for Istanbul. Kurum, who was a former environment minister, lost the Istanbul mayoral election for his opponent Ekrem İmamoğlu with a 12% difference.
I will persist in my endeavors for this city. We will be present among the people in the streets following President Erdogan's guidance. Our nation's message are of most importance and we are committed to interpreting and acting on these insights for a better future for our country.
Turkey's opposition Republican People's Party dealt a severe blow to President Erdogan and his party by winning major cities and several provinces in the country. Analysts say this is the result of neglect from the ruling party to the voters' demands in previous elections. Among several issues, the economic crisis and Erdogan's inability to control the lira drop was the main issue for voters. Another one was his double standards on Gaza, which forced many of his supporters to vote for other Islamist parties.
What happened in local elections is punitive voting from the people. We expected the ruling Justice and Development Party to lose in both Istanbul and Ankara. Once again, what this surprising result shows that there is a major setback and that their supporters are trying to send a message. Economy, alliances and parties' performance declined during 22 years are part of it. However, the main issue is that Islamists who are supporting AKP were expecting a different stance from the war on Gaza.
The opposition party did not only win Istanbul, but also seized several districts from AKP that were considered a stronghold of the ruling party. Turkish people believe that a change is needed and that both the ruling party and opposition need to work for the sake of the country and its people.
I think that Recep Tayyip Erdogan deserved it. Why? Because first he did not raise the retirement salaries. elderly will lose to vote for Erdogan for 23 years. Yesterday they gave their vote to CHP. Prices are raising every day with same salary. Economy is worsening. He says we learned our lesson for the past 30 years. Didn't you learn the lesson?
More than 61 million were eligible to vote. Voters' turnout was registered at 76% across 81 provinces. The local elections results are alarming for the ruling party. Many are considering it a chance for opposition parties to unite and start preparing for the 2028 presidential run if they want to oust Erdogan and his party. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Iranians took to the streets of the capital Tehran and gathered at iconic Palestine Square at midnight after the deadly Israeli attack on Iran's embassy in Syria. They chanted death to the Israeli regime and death to America as they waved Palestine flags. The protesters expressed their support for Palestinian people in Gaza as Israel's genocidal war continues unabated.
When we heard what has happened, we couldn't tolerate it, and we came here for the sake of our martyrs. Our Muslim brothers and sisters, Palestinians, Syrians, are all a part of our own nation, and there's no difference between us.
Two of our generals were martyred, so we have gathered here to show our readiness for retaliation. We are asking the Islamic Republic of Iran to take serious action against these atrocities and the disrespect towards our nation and also the innocent Palestinians.
On Monday, Iran's ambassador to Damascus, Hossein Akbari, confirmed that Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi and his deputy Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi were killed in the Israeli attack.
It is our duty to come out because we felt that even though the resistance movement is showing patience towards the Israeli regime, we are still witnessing that the regime is pressing ahead with its atrocities with the recent incident of the attack on the Iranian consulate.
We have gathered here at this hour to show that the innocent martyrs in Syria were killed amid injustice and impunity by the bloody hands of the Zionist regime. The regime has been killing innocent people, especially children, for many years.
The attack came as almost 6 months into the Gaza hostilities, the regime has failed to achieve its objectives of destroying Hamas, despite killing tens of thousands of Palestinians, mostly women and children. The two slain Iranian generals had been comrades of top Iranian anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani, who was also assassinated in an attack in January 3, 2020. General Soleimani played a key role in fighting and decimating the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group in the region, particularly in Iraq and Syria.
A large number of people have gathered here in Palestine Square to strongly condemn the recent Israeli attack on the Iranian consular in the capital of Syria, Damascus. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
In a statistic which may amaze and anger those in their 20s and 30s, in 1973, the average French person dedicated just 10% of their income to housing. In places like Lisbon, that figure is now 63%. As the housing situation across Europe is being called the worst it has been in 70 years. With winter prohibitions on evictions ending with the arrival of spring, protests are being held across Europe against the lack of affordable housing.
Houses are made for living in and not for financial speculation. This is a fundamental truth which has been forgotten by successive French governments. They have turned their back on the many victims of our long-running housing crisis, and across Europe it's the same. What's worse is that they'll have many people evicted by landlords looking to cash out on tourist money for the Summer Olympics.
One out of four French people suffer from a serious housing problem, so it's no surprise that better housing has been a top issue for voters in election after election.
There's a real lack of decent, new, and safe housing in France and Europe, as much of our stock dates from after World War II. The laws requiring that 20% of lodgings be made available to lower-income citizens is not enforced, and we just don't see that the government cares about the incredible difficulty of finding affordable housing here in France.
In Paris, housing prices are up a back-breaking 70% since 2009, the start of the great financial crisis, and the failed response of far-right economic austerity. The hiking of interest rates in 2022 caused some housing markets in Europe to decline slightly, but others continued to rise. That also caused building costs to soar, reducing private construction. Housing groups insist that lodging issues could be fixed nationwide in just 5 to 10 years if the government's laws favored renters and regular citizens instead of landowners and real estate speculators. The primary culprit seems to lie in the refusal of right-wing economics to allow governments to invest tax revenue in building more affordable real estate, and also in the vast sell-offs to private corporations of government housing since the 1980s. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
This year, the holy month of Ramadan in Pakistan has been dedicated to the oppressed people of Gaza, with Pakistanis asserting that they will never forget the plight of Palestinians in war-torn Gaza. Throughout Ramadan, they have continued to raise their voices against Israel's brutalities and the genocidal war on Gaza. This week, activists from Save Gaza campaign organized protest demonstrations in all major cities of the country. They also staged protest sit-ins to condemn what they perceive as Israel's barbarism in Gaza.
Pakistan should move on international fora, United Nations, OIC and other international fora for ceasefire, to save Gaza, to save Palestinians, to stop this genocide, number one. Number two, establish a humanitarian assistance corridor. Number three, start proceeding against Israel in International Court of Justice and International Criminal Court, and also on the platform of the OIC for their war crimes, for their crime against humanity in Gaza.
While leaving the comfort of their houses behind, individuals from different faiths and backgrounds gather on the streets, setting up makeshift iftar meals to break their fast during Ramadan. These gatherings were not just about sharing food, they were about sharing solidarity, empathy, and hope for the people of Gaza.
This is the message from D Chowk, Islamabad, Pakistan, that we are with you. Our hearts are beating in Gaza, and for the regimes across the globe, our message is that you have been exposed. Your so-called democracy, your so-called freedom of speech, your so-called international humanitarian law are badly exposed.
Images of destruction and suffering from the Israeli war sparked a wave of empathy among people from various walks of life in Pakistan, prompting them to increase their advocacy campaign within their communities for the plight of oppressed people in Gaza.
The gesture of Pakistanis holding protest demonstrations and breaking their fasts on the streets to show solidarity with the oppressed people of Gaza underscores their steadfast commitment to amplifying voices against Israel's ongoing genocide and advocating for a ceasefire. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Turkish people in 81 provinces took to the polls to choose mayors and provincial council members in local elections. The vote is seen by many as a test of popularity of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan, who started his political life as the mayor of Istanbul, campaigned for the past few weeks to promote his party's candidates. The ruling Justice and Development Party is seeking to win back both the economic hub of the country, Istanbul, and capital Ankara, after receiving a blow from Republican People's Party, CHP, in 2019. For his turn, the CHP is scrambling to maintain both cities and win more. All eyes are now on Istanbul, as the competition between the two main candidates in the city is crucial.
The participation wasn't expected to be the same as the previous election. However, it's not less important than the 2023 one. Erdogan wants to end his presidential term with a victory for his party. And opposition candidate Ekrem İmamoğlu, who wants to participate in the 2028 presidential run, wants this local election to pave the way for his next win.
61 million voters were eligible to vote, with more than 1 million new voters.
I cast my vote for the very first time. I am happy I was able to practice my democratic right. It does not matter who wins, as long as he works for this city and for our district. I want the best for my city, aside from political ideologies.
Mayor of Istanbul Ekrem İmamoğlu and the AKP's candidate Murat Kurum were campaigning for improving services for the city's 60 million residents at a time of widespread economic hardship and double-digit inflation. İmamoğlu has been criticized during his term for heavily focusing on presidential election and his party's leadership rather than solving issues in the city, such as the transportation and the traffic problems and multitude of other issues when heavy snowfall crippled life in Istanbul.
For the past 10 years, I have been living in Istanbul, and I found that the previous mayor, he didn't give the promise he planned to do inside Istanbul. According to the service, the management of the city, we didn't find any change in this situation. For that, I preferred to give the AK Party again, because I think they lost the election last time. It was like a kind of punishment from the people, and I think they learned a good from this lesson.
Opposition party supporters consider this election as another chance to topple the Justice and Development Party and win back power in the country.
I voted for Ekrem İmamoğlu and CHP. I have always supported CHP and will vote for them every time, for this could be our last exit from this nightmare.
Erdogan, who was the mayor of Istanbul in 1994, said during a rally that Istanbul is the jewel, the treasure, and the apple of our country's eye. Analysts say the person that rules Istanbul is able to establish himself a political base, which then translates into power at the national scale. Who wins Istanbul wins Turkey. That's what Erdogan, a mayor of the city in the 1990s, was quoted by a pollster as saying. Against that backdrop, Istanbul today could be choosing Turkey's future president. Roshan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was the 11th time the British capital had played host to another national demonstration against the US-led Israeli genocide of Palestinians inside Gaza. Coincidentally, this march was taking place on an auspicious day for Palestinians. March 30th is commemorated as Land Day to mark the 1976 Israeli killing of six Palestinians and the wounding of scores more who had gathered to show their affinity for a land that has literally witnessed the constant shedding of Palestinian blood. In an act of solidarity with Palestine, central London showed it would not be letting up on the pressure. Flash forward to this most recent attempt to ethnically cleanse Palestine of its people, and it's clear the UK is being blasted for its complicity in allowing a ceasefire motion to go unacknowledged by Tel Aviv. A comparatively small counter-demo by pro-Israel supporters was peacefully drowned out by pro-Palestinians. The protesters taking part in the demo had a variety of reasons why their presence on the marches mattered.
We just want to bring this conflict into the consciousness of everyone, so everyone understands what's going on here. You know, children being slaughtered, you know, women being slaughtered, the schools and hospitals just completely destroyed. You know, it's just inhumane. It's just beyond imagination.
Yeah. We have to stop this. We have to. Don't you? No one can be blind to what's happening. It has to stop. It has to stop. Showing ourselves like this, demonstrating how horrified and outraged we are, and then boycott Israel.
Demonstrators have pledged to keep turning out in the streets to protest against the genocide in Gaza until there's a cessation of violence and justice for Palestinians. Amina Taylor, London.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is me, Asma. Once more, I have the pleasure to be at your service. And then here with me, I have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Mustafa, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum assalam.
I would love you both to introduce yourself pretty briefly.
My name is Nahid, and I'm so honored to be with you and your listeners today.
Thank you very much for being here, and you, Brother Mustafa.
My name is Mustafa, and I'm studying here in the Hausa. I'm studying psychology here, and I'm originally from Pakistan, but I've lived in different countries.
So, thank you very much, both of you, for coming here and for joining us in today's episode. So, let me go so straight into the question that, what would you do for the happiness of the people around you?
Be happy myself, I guess.
you be happy for the happiness of other people?
Well, it depends. What exactly are you asking? You know, what point of view are you asking me from?
And there are different perspective to it, actually. First, you tell me your impression totally of the question that you're being asked. Like, whenever you want to make people happy, would you go to different extremes to make people happy? Like your family, your friends?
Of course, you know, there's this very popular saying in English, which is, you know, you can't make everyone happy, right?
You're not a Nutella jar.
Yeah, so life isn't always that way. But I think in order to be happy ourselves and to help others, it's just to be as sort of maybe as nice to people as you can, you know, have good manners, for example. Those are things which will help you be better and help others feel happy as well.
So what about you, sister?
First of all, I also believe in that quote that you can't please everyone and it's impossible to do. There are too many ways based on the different situations. Like, I don't know, if I want to make one of my family members happy, I know what that person likes, then I can do that for her.
So you would do everything to make other people happy?
Not everything, but the thing that makes them happy, like, I have the limits as well.
There are borderlines.
Yeah, sure.
But there should be. But we would make other people happy.
If we consider the society, there are too many ways, like, I don't know, charity, the things that are even regarded and suggested in our religion. But considering the family, regarding the borderlines, thinking of the things that would make them happy, I can do them for them. Like, I don't know, buying gifts, doing the thing that they like. Or even sometimes providing them with their favorite stuff.
Yeah. So generally speaking, what are the things that would make human beings happy?
So I think a lot of times we do, like, you know, especially in a family environment, I think many times we do have to make sacrifices to make our family happy, right? For example, let's say I'm washing the dishes to help, you know, my wife, right? I may not like doing that, but I feel like that's necessary so that I can help her and that will make her happy at the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of times we do have to do things which may not necessarily please us, but we know it helps them. But you'll see that person will then also return that, you know, favor as well.
I just asked what makes human beings happy and I want to know your answer.
When we devote time and when we think about them and they see this courage in ourselves, they see that we are working for them and for their good, this can really help our life, our personal life, our, I don't know, social life to be moving forward.
We do make people happy because we have relationships and it's just a two-way sort of a relationship.
It's part of our personality. Like,
we have to give it to get it.
Yeah.
But,
so,
you know, at times it's not always a two-way street, right? For example, like, let's say you have to, like, do something that your parents are asking you to do. You may not be getting anything in return out of that. You just have to do it, right? Or maybe, like, say you're at work for your employer, sometimes you're just going to have to do things. I mean, I know you're getting, like, compensation out of it, but still, like, it's not always, like, a two-way street. Sometimes you do have to be sacrificing for others. And even in Islam, I think we have this concept that, you should really be doing it for the sake of God's happiness.
Yeah,
right?
Not your intention is very important.
Right? You know, others may not always treat you well. You may not always get what you want out of them, for example. But if you're doing it for the sake of God, then He will give you that happiness and peace. Right?
Yeah, but there is this wrong notion among people that if you're a kind person, that if you wish everyone to be happy, then they would call you a people pleaser. Mm. Now, let's go for a break and then just think about it. After the break, give me your answers.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So, welcome back. This is Back to Reality. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I am Asma. Sister Nahida and Brother Mustafa are helping us with the topic of kindness, doing everything to make other people happy. By the way, not every single person in this world would have the same perspective that, okay, I have to do everything to make everyone happy. I asked about the people pleaser label that sometimes would be attached to you as a person in society. Like, you're so kind and you have too much of sympathy and empathy with people. You would do things like, whether it's compensation or sacrifice, but you would do things for people to make them happy. Still, you're going to be called the people pleaser.
First of all, I guess we should know the borderline between being the victim of the other people or being kind to them. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I have seen too many people that are just being too much kind to the other people that they are not being seen. Even the other person doesn't see the good actions or the good deeds of the person. But not going forwards from that borderline, staying kind, I guess that's not a problem.
How can you recognize that border, like between being a victim?
That is the thing that makes it too challenging, and that is the point that makes people think, like, in a toxic way, that you are being the person who is not getting the things that person has given.
Because you know what I mean? I mean, generally speaking, you don't understand that people are looking at you like that unless you get to the very last straw. Like, it's the ending point, and you figure out that people are just thinking that whatever you do, like, as if they're the center of the world and everybody has to...
Yeah, I think one way, sometimes you can tell people are taking advantage of your being nice and kindness, you know, in the sense that they will abuse or misuse, you
exactly.
know, your being nice. I think in those situations, you definitely want to be more assertive. You want to be, you know, you have your sort of, have confidence in understanding yourself. So this is very much related to understanding ourselves mm-hmm. and the yeah. world. It reminds me of a really beautiful discussion that we had with one of our teachers. So the class is about crisis management, you know, what happens during crisis management. So our teacher was saying there's four dimensions to us. If any one of these four dimensions, we don't understand it well, we're going to be suffering, right? And he says, one is our own self, how we define our own self. Second is how we define others in the world. Third is how we define, like, where we came from. You know, what's our source, which is obviously God. And the final is, you know, where we're going to end up, right? Day of judgment or, you know, heaven, hell, all that kind of. So he said, if any one of these four is missing from someone's life, they're not going to have a very good life. All of our interactions, mm-hmm. all of our how we view life. Yeah.
And our own priorities, like, we shouldn't forget about ourselves. And people really forget their own needs, wants, and just consider life as their own mission to help other people and please them. If we set our priorities, if we devote some time for others, know that it's our duty to help the people around us, but at the same time, have ourselves too, have
exactly.
our own needs and wants as well,
now,
and value them.
That's very important to have a moderation between yourself and the world around you. So it's good to be nice, and we have been asked and recommended to be nice and kind to other people, but then there is an extreme to that. It has got some borders. You should not forget about yourself and about your borders, so everything must be considered. So I guess we have to go for another break, and then we'll be back to see what's going on next.
Music.
There actually are a lot of psychological questions to figure out what kind of a person you are. Everybody has a definition for kindness, for these sort of human being sort of relationships that they have in this world. Like, we all see kindness differently. Maybe someone is going to do you something wrong, but they're doing it based on their own